For the Vashti part, I'm going to be very happy. I had an idea which I haven't heard others say, but I think it's correct. You'll tell me what you think, and we'll see. First of all, I want to thank the sponsors for the shiur today. First of all, in general, for the class through the year, Dana and Ilan Rubinstein. And then the following gifts from our day of giving in July: Carol and Stuart Lesser, Ralph Levine, and Rena and Richard Levy. And we're also dedicated by Danny and Ellen Gordon in memory of Ruchama Chava Rachel, Rachel Kantrowitz, on her first yard site, Monday the 15th of Cheshvan. Shama should have an aliyah. Okay, so we are still on Ahasuerus's party, and we're looking at three approaches to that party. Just to remind everybody from last week, we started on the first approach. The first approach is really the most basic, straightforward, fits the text very well, and that is the party is a demonstration of Ahasuerus's obsession with power and status. So that we started out by pointing out that it's when he's sitting on his throne and how odd that is, because it's year three, what's he been doing until now, and the insight of the Malbim suggesting that Ahasuerus actually ordered a new throne. He wants to demonstrate his power. He has moved the capital to Shushan, and he has built a new throne. We are also introduced to Ahasuerus as a schemer. He makes one party for the leadership and another party for all the locals. We discuss the Gemara's question of whether Ahasuerus is really smart or whether he's foolish. Is it a good strategy or a bad strategy? But fundamentally, he is a schemer. And that's what we pick up with this week. I wanted to show you another way in which we see Ahasuerus plotting as we read this chapter. And if you take a look in your Megillat Esther, in the book itself, chapter 1, sentence 4, right, there's a lot to be said about this sentence. I'm going to call it up on my own here. Actually, I'll just use my dot micro edition. It's easier. So, chapter 1, sentence 4, we are informed that Ahasuerus is making his party, v'haroto et osher kavod malchuto, because he wants to show off his wealth, the honor of his empire, the et yikar tiferet gedulato, and the glory of the splendor of his greatness. You hear all these words, right? It isn't enough to just say his tiferet, his splendor. No, no, no. Yikar tiferet gedulato. Yikar, something that is yakar. What does yakar mean?
Dear.
Sorry, dear. Okay. What else do we use the word yakar to mean? Expensive, somebody said, right? Yakar means expensive. It also means heavy, interestingly. The word kavod is often translated in Aramaic as yakar. And I think that goes together. It's the classic kavod, kaved, right? Something that is kaved is heavy, something that kavod is honor. It is yakar, the heavy honor of tiferet, the splendor of gidulato, his greatness. In case you didn't know about him. Yamim rabim shmonim umat yom. And he's going to do this for 180 days. That's the six-month feast. And yeah, in terms of why 6 months, just as an aside, I think the answer is simply that he has to. Because he's making this feast for all the nobles from all the lands, it's not as though they're all able to show up at once, right? They're going to make it when they're going to make it. And he can't, I don't think anyone is staying for 6 months. I think that they're showing up from their different lands and they stay as they stay. Otherwise, you'd have a situation in which the entire empire is out its leadership for 6 months, which is a little hard to imagine. But that's not the focus. The focus is actually the next line. Uvimlo tayamim ha'ele. And after that, after he's completed the 6 months, so we're in chapter 1, sentence 5. Asa ha-melech l'chol ha'am ha-nimtzi'im b'shushan ha-bira, the king prepared for the entire nation, for everybody who is in Shushan, l'migadol v'yad katan, from great to small, significant to lowliest. Mishteh shiv'at yamim, a 7-day party, b'chatzar ginat bitan ha-melech. That part at the end of the sentence is hard to understand. Chatzar ginat Bitan Hamelech. Chatzar, chatzer, word I was just using with Susan actually before we started the class. A chatzer is a?
Courtyard.
A yard, a courtyard. Okay. Gina is?
Garden.
A garden. Okay, so you have courtyard, you've got a garden, you've got a garden. Bitan. What's a bitan? Some of you...
Small house.
Small house. Like kind of diminutive for a house. There's a bayit and then there's a bitan. Maybe. Some of you have translations there. Anyone have anything interesting for bitan?
Mine strangely says the king's palace.
The palace. You have an orchard for bitan. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are a lot of different ways that bitan is taken, largely because it's such an unusual word. It's not a word for which we have a lot of evidence to work with. The one I hear often is indeed palace, which I think Jeanette said she had. And
that's the art scroll.
Okay. But that doesn't make it wrong. Sorry?
Rashi says planted with trees.
Planted with trees, because he's taking the orchard view. But it's such an odd thing. Sorry, Joyce?
It's the fact that it says court, a comparison to the temple?
I wouldn't think so. It's an interesting idea, because, of course, the temple has a courtyard. But I think it's more just the way that royalty works. Like, you have your palace and you have your courtyard outside. But take a look at the first source on the source sheet. Okay, and again, I hope everybody got the email and was able to download it without trouble. If anyone doesn't have it, let me know, please, and I'll upload it into the chat. Okay. So the Gemara in Megillah in source number one. Look at this. Bachatzar ginat bitan hamelech, which I translated there in the yard of the garden of the house of the king. And again, this is like ponderous phrasing. So Rav and Shmuel had a debate. You see this a lot in the Gemara and Megillah, that Rav and Shmuel debate how to explain particular passages found in the book of Esther. So Chad Amar, Haro'i lechatzer lechatzer, Haro'i legina legina, Haro'i lebitan lebitan. One view was that the way he did it was, you got a space based on your status in the community. So there were different places for people of different ranks. Some people were in the courtyard, some people were in the garden, and some people made it into the house. I'll leave it to everybody to evaluate where they would have ended up. But that's one view. V'chad Omar, alternative approach, Hoshivan b'chatzer v'lo hachzikatan. There was an issue of overflow. So first he put them in the yard. That was not sufficient. Baginai put them in the garden v'lo hachzikatan. That didn't hold them. Ad shechnisan lebitan v'chzikatan. And then he had to put them into the palace. So they keep expanding. He wanted them outside, but they kept on overflowing the outer spaces. It's kind of odd. Usually I would think of that in reverse, right? Usually you're indoors and then you have to go outside to be able to do it. Here, it's actually the opposite direction. So that's a kind of funny thing. I got a note in the chat that somebody did not have the source sheet. So I'm just going to do a quick upload of it. Let's just do it. And there
it
is. That's all right. I just did it. Thank you, though. Maybe next time I'll ask you to do it. So that's a second approach. So they were either there are different places for people of different rank, or alternatively they expanded into different places. You're going to see the same thing. I didn't bring it on the sheet, but the Gemara does the same thing in sentence six, where we get a description in the Megillah of Chur, Karpas, Utchelet, right? Different fabrics. And the Gemara does the same thing, saying, well, those who were worthy got this level, those who were less worthy got that level, those who were less worthy got that level. This is all part of the image of Ahasuerus as a calculating man who is obsessed with status. He's making a big party, and all he can think about is who is going to get to go where, and delineating between the different groups. Tosfot, by the way, has a very interesting comment on this. I didn't bring it on the sheet. On the psychology of not being disturbed by which space you're given if you can't see who's in the better spaces. In other words, he says, if Ahasuerus is doing this, doesn't he know he's going to be insulting people who are left on the outside? So he says, no, as long as you can't see who's in the better space, you're okay with where you are. As long as you can't see who outranks you. Interesting idea. But this is all one school of thought about the party, and there are many, many more aspects of these verses that we could bring to support this reading. But I wanted instead to show you two other approaches. Second approach to this story, and you've heard bits and pieces of this at least, is that it's a celebration of Jewish defeat. It is a function of the exile of the Jews. And this goes back to the question of why he's making a party like this in the third year of his reign. Not in year one, and not after 20 years. What is it about year three? So the Gemara in Megillah, if you take a look at source number two, and I spared you the math. I know some people here really like math, but nonetheless, I decided to spare the group as a whole. The math that's involved. But the Gemara suggests that Ahasuerus' mind was at ease in year three because he believed that the Jews had reached the end of their predicted period of exile, and yet they're still under his control, and therefore they will remain under his control. Take a look at number two, please. Vayamim ha'hem kishevet ha'melech. In those days when the king sat, uchtiv batrei bishnat shalosh lemolcho. But then it says in year three of his reign. I don't understand. Is it when he sat, or is it year three? Amar Rava, my kishevet. Rava says, what do you mean, when the king sat? La'achar shenityashva da'ato. After his mind was set at ease. Amar, Belshazzar chishev v'ta'a, anachashivna v'lota'ina. So this requires a little bit of explanation. But again, I really want to spare everybody the calculations. Remember that the end of the first Beit HaMikdash, the end of the first temple, is not a single event in which at first the Jews are okay in their land with a temple, and then suddenly it's all over. It goes in stages. There are three different dates that you could consider the end of the first temple period, of the first Beit HaMikdash. There is when Nebuchadnezzar comes through, deposes the king, and sets up his own puppet as a king. Then there is when Nebuchadnezzar comes through and exiles the leadership, who are called Cheresh Umasger. That's when Daniel goes into exile with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's the exile we'll read about in the second chapter of the book of Esther. And then you have the third, which is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash itself. Regardless of which of those you work with, you have a prediction by the prophet Yirmiyahu that the Jews will be in exile for 70 years. But he doesn't say when that exile actually begins. Fast forward to the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, in the fifth chapter, we are told that Belshazzar, while in the middle of a war with the Persians and Medes, makes a massive feast. And not only does he make a massive feast, but he orders them to bring the vessels of the temple, of the Beit HaMikdash, out to his party. Not talking about now something that the sages infer. It's explicit in the text in Daniel chapter 5. So the question that you have to ask is, what is Belshazzar doing making a big feast in the middle of a war? And by the way, he's losing the war. And number two, why does he have the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, brought out? What's the connection here? And so what the Gemara suggests is that if you do the math, you realize that that year, when Belshazzar does this, is year 70, if you're counting from one particular landmark within those three stages of the exile. I don't remember if it was the first or the second right now. The Gemara goes through it. So when I said I'm trying to spare you the math, that was a euphemism. I'm sparing myself the math. So, but Belshazzar is doing is he's making a feast to say, aha, see that? Judea Capta, to use an anachronism. He's saying, I have defeated the Jews. I am bringing out the vessels of their temple at my party, which, of course, doesn't end well, right? Ken, bediuk, so tomishte. Ruchama points out that's when the writing on the wall emerges, right? The writing that says to him, you are basically, you have been weighed and found wanting. There are different ways to explain those words. But fundamentally, that night, Belshazzar is killed. That's what it says in the book of Daniel, as the Persians and the Medes destroy the Babylonian Empire and subsume it into their own. So what the Gemara here is doing is it says, you know what? Ahasuerus is Belshazzar round two. And that's going to show up more in some things I hope to get to later today. We'll see, in Vashti's party. But right now, Belshazzar is effectively reborn as Ahasuerus. When he makes his party, it's because he believes that now the Jews are done, and he says Belshazzar is wrong with his. I am not making the same mistake as Belshazzar. I am right in my math. That's the idea. And the text goes on to actually describe for you what Belshazzar had done at his party. You can see it there in the Gemara in source number 2. I'm going to skip that to where I wrote, Ahasuerus said, Amar Ahasuerus. Iu mit atoi. Belshazzar got it wrong. Anachashim nevelo ta'ina. I'm not going to make the same mistake. He saw 70 years were up and the Jews had not yet been redeemed. He says, they're done. They're not going to be redeemed anymore. I'm going to take out the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash and I'm going to use them. And in comes the Satan and dances among them and he kills Vashti. And that, we're not there yet. But the idea here is, first of all, we're linking Ahasuerus to another king. You may recall that last week we linked Ahasuerus to Sanherib, the Assyrian king. Now we're linking him to Belshazzar. And he's like both of them. What's the common denominator between Ahasuerus, Belshazzar, and Sanherib? Well, yeah, they're all bad guys. That's true. What else? They thought they were very powerful, they said they were very powerful, and they fell to God. Right? That's the idea. God is going to bring down each of them. But they also all play a role in the suffering of the Jews. This may... Yes, Janine.
The chronology, I'm a little confused. When did Belshazzar live vis-a-vis Ahasuerus?
Yes. So Belshazzar is the last king of the Babylonian Empire in Tanakh.
And was there 3 years? There would have had to be a three-year...
You have more than a three-year gap, because after Belshazzar, you then have Koresh, you have Cyrus.
Okay, thank you. But didn't we say he was wrong with the 70 years and three, like... Each one had made a mistake.
Right, but it's not a three-year period in between. Cyrus is king for longer than that, as I recall. We went through his years, I forget, in the first week in terms of how long Cyrus was on the throne, but it's longer than that. The one thing that you do that you are pointing out that I want to make sure to highlight, because someone emailed me about this during the week and I answered them, but I want to make sure to clarify it for everybody. It is unquestionable that Ahasuerus is doing this after the Jews have been sent back by Cyrus to build the second Beit HaMikdash. You know that because the Persians don't have 127 lands until after that. There's no way for Ahasuerus to be before Cyrus. It's simply impossible. So what that means is that his count, as the Gemara tells us, of the 70 years, he's not saying the Jews are all still in exile. The Jews have indeed, 42,000 have come back, right, in that initial wave, at least. But they're still under his control. I'm just going to mute everybody by default, but if you want to make a comment or ask a question, feel free to unmute.
Okay.
So that's really important to recognize here, is that this is after Cyrus, and he's simply saying they're still under Persian control. Clear? Okay, Gita, you have a worried look on your face. You got it? You're muted, though.
No, I never got your sheet, and I didn't want to bother you again.
Got it. Well, I put it in the chat.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No problem. No problem at all. Okay. So this is one piece of text that supports the idea that the feast is meant to celebrate the fall of the Jews. It's a function of our exile. And a Medrash even builds on that in source number 3. A little bit of an odd Medrash, hard to understand. It says he's sitting al kisei malchuto, on the throne of his reign. So the Medrash is bothered. It's written chaser, it's missing a vav. It's written melachto. What would I do with that word? So it answers, he actually tried to sit on the throne of Shlomo. Shlomo has a famous throne, as described in Malachim Aleph. Midrashim expand on it. He wanted to sit on Shlomo's throne, velo hinichuhu, and it wouldn't let him. I don't know what that means, but it wouldn't let him. Amru lo, and they said to him, kol melech she'eno kozmi kartur. A king who is not like cosmic, a king who does not reign over everything, doesn't get to sit on Shlomo's throne. Eino yosheva lav. Amad va'aslo kisei mishalo kidmuto. He said, that's fine, I have all the money in the world. I'm going to make my own throne. It'll look just like his. And it's going to be huge. And there's nothing that anybody can do to stop me from making a throne that's just like Shlomo's throne. That's what the Medrash sees. The Medrash seems to be building on the idea that without the Aleph, you could read Malchuto as being like Milachto, his work, the throne of his crafting. The only problem is, if you look at the word malchuto in your text in chapter, again, it's in sentence 2, chapter 1, sentence 2. How is the word malchuto written?
I have a vav.
Yeah, so do I.
No aleph. But yeah. No aleph.
Well, there isn't supposed to be an aleph.
Yeah, malacha?
If it really were malacha, but it's malchuto, there's not supposed to be an aleph. Right. So the Eitz Yosef commentary on this Medrash suggests that some scribe at some point in recording this Medrash made a mistake, and that it wasn't that it was written chaser, missing a vav, but rather the idea is kisei malchuto instead of kisei hamalchut. Kisei hamalchut would be the throne of the empire. Kisei malchuto says it's his, because he has one made for himself, because he can't sit on the one that he wants. In any case, I'm not focusing on the Kisei Malchuto, I'm focusing on the idea that he wants to sit on the throne of King Solomon. That's really the important part, and it feeds into a Gemara on sentence 4 in this chapter. We read this sentence, Yekar Tiferet Gedulato, the honor of the splendor of, however you want to do it, the honor of the splendor of his greatness. So the Gemara looks at that and says, Tiferet is a word we know. Tiferet is a word that we use regarding clothing of the Kohanim. And so take a look at source number 4. This teaches, I'm reading my English translation in the interests of time, this teaches that he wore the clothing of the Kohen. Because here it says, Yikar Tiferet Kedulato, the glory of the splendor of his greatness. And there it says, L'chavod u'l'tiferet, for honor and for splendor. So the Gemara says that he is, that he's actually wearing the clothing of the Kohanim. The Medrash is motivated by a textual problem. What is Yikar Tiferet Gedulato? What does it add to Osher Kavod Malchuto in the first part of the sentence? The sentence already talked about the wealth of the honor of his reign. What is it adding with the honor of the splendor of his greatness? So it suggests it's talking about the clothing of the Kohanim, but it's doing something else. And it's a very important thing, which is it's highlighting Ahasuerus' use of the property of the Jews and the holy property of the Jews. It's meant, again, to emphasize our exile. It shows Achashverosh as a member of the nations admiring the grandeur of the Kohen Gadol and wanting it for himself and celebrating our defeat. Are we clear? Or am I going too fast? We good? Nods or thumbs down. You can thumb down. That's fine too. Except for the people whose videos aren't on. You have to find some other way to let me know. But the one more medrash, which you have to bring up in discussing this. Sorry, yes?
Does Tiferet also represent jealousy?
Would Tiferet represent jealousy? What would
am
be the...
I confusing someone else?
I don't know why Tiferet would be jealousy. I'm open to the idea.
Okay, I'm confusing it with something else.
Okay. Right, if you find what, then let me know. But there's one more medrash that you really have to talk about here. And this is one that we generally learn in school or we hear it in shul. And it's a fascinating medrash, but it's extremely problematic. I gave a full-length class on it some years back, and in source number 5 I gave you a link if you want to catch the recording on it. It's on the vessels that they drink from at the party. If you look at chapter 1, sentence 6, this is the part where the person who is doing the reading, actually sentence 7, I said 6, but I meant 7. The person who's doing the reading often will change the trop, right? Will change the notes to use the Eicha notes. V'hashkot b'chlei zahav v'chelim mikelim shonim. They drank from gold vessels and kelim, tools, implements, vessels, mikelim shonim. And the medrash on this says, you know what these were? These were the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. And he drank from those vessels. Right? You've heard this idea before? That he uses the vessels of the temple. What is this medrash picking up on? What bothers the medrash here?
The word shonim?
Yeah. What about it?
It's extraneous. It's like, why is it there?
Well, is it that it's extraneous? What does it mean?
Strange. It's strange. Mm-hmm. It doesn't.
Wait, before we talk about what happened to the vessels, what does the word mean?
Different. Vessels like the Tamikdash were mostly silver, and he showed up with clay zahav, and then other vessels, which are not zahav.
So,
most of them were silver.
So, yes, but I think I'm asking a question first, which I think some people are trying to answer here also, which is, the word shonim means different, like mishuneh, shinui, okay? And the problem that we have is I don't understand the text. He drank from, or he had his people drink from, gold vessels and different vessels. Or even worse, he had them drink from gold vessels and mismatched vessels.
They just drank a lot.
I understand that they're drinking, but I don't understand what you mean. Different vessels? Achashverosh doesn't have a full set? No one for his weddings gave him anything? Yeah, Rebecca.
Safaria translated as very designed.
Which translation are they using? Which
translation?
No, but Safaria has multiple translations available on their site. They have the Koran one, they have the JPS 1917, 1985, so you have to see which one they're using. But this is what the Medrash is bothered by. And there are a whole range of answers to explain what this word shonim or mishunim actually means. So Rashi says, What it means is a wide variety of options for people. Ahasuerus put out a great range of vessels. You want gold, use gold. You want silver, use silver. You want marble, you got marble. Whatever you like. That's the way Rashi reads it. Malbim says, for some reason, that shonim actually means it was a full set of utensils in one. I'm not clear on how he gets that out of shonim, but that's what he says. There's a medrash, this is fascinating, which says that it was that people drank from a different cup each time. Each time you wanted a drink, you got a fresh cup. All sorts of different explanations for what shonim may mean. You have a Medrash in Esther Rabbah that says that people who looked at these vessels, their faces would change in shame before their beauty. Their faces were shonim or mishunim would change. But what you have here in the Gemara in source number 6, they point out that it's shonim instead of mishunim. Really, if it meant different, maybe it should have said mishunim. And they suggest that shonim means repeating, to do something again. Meaning, Persia is repeating what Babylon did. Ahasuerus is repeating what Belshazzar did. We know Belshazzar brought out the vessels at his feast. And look, Ahasuerus did the same here. Just like we've said he's like Belshazzar before, so too he's like Belshazzar now. Now, there's a lot to be said about this medrash. That's why I gave you the link in source number 5 if you want to hear a whole class about it. But I want to just show you 3 levels in this medrash. On a simple level, this shows, as I said before, that the meal is a degradation of God and the Jews. That's one level. Fits in also with the Gemara that we're going to come back to that says that the Jews ate at the meal and that that was so terrible because they ate at a meal that celebrated their downfall. That's one read. Second level is that it's a medrash about Ahasuerus. You're linking him with Belshazzar as a disreputable villain. Belshazzar is a bad guy. And not only is Belshazzar a bad guy, but Belshazzar is a bad guy who gets no respect. It's very striking, and this is a long story, but in that chapter in Daniel, Belshazzar offers Daniel great gifts for interpreting the writing on the wall. And Daniel says to him, you can keep your gifts. Daniel didn't say that to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar gave Daniel gifts, and he never said that to him. But with Belshazzar, Daniel says, you can keep your gifts, I don't want them. There's, you know, think of Avram and the king of Sodom. I don't want anything from you. Belshazzar is low class. And Ahasuerus is now getting that status as well as we compare him with Belshazzar. And then a third level, and this is a much bigger point, but it's a medrash about our redemption. Because the vessels are highlighted when we go into exile, when the Babylonians take them. We're told that Nebuchadnezzar kept them in the in his temple with his gods. And then they go through this degradation, but Cyrus sends them home. So that the ark of our redemption is the ark of the vessels. And there's actually a lot to say about that, about the journey of the vessels and the journey of the Jews. Moshe, I see your hand. Hang on. But that's just something that's also worth noting. The big problem with the vessels is just that the chronology, I think I mentioned this week one, the chronology is wrong. Cyrus sent back all the vessels, and the text goes out of its way in Ezra to say he sent back all the vessels. So Ahasuerus doesn't have any vessels. So you could give an answer of maybe there was something else still around, or maybe Ahasuerus, you know, ordered some shipped back for him for his party. Yeah, maybe that's why it took him 6 months. The postal service was busy. Or it's possible that that this has nothing to do with that at all, and it's simply Medrash doing what Medrash does, which is to say it's not focused on the overall story. It's focused on explaining the language here and drawing lessons from it. And it doesn't have to fit the history element. You could give that answer as well. Moshe, what were you going to say?
So now you've just explained something to me that I've never understood. But this was why I started. The pasuk says, "V'chelim mikhevin shonim."
Could be.
And I think that Ezra would have been in no position to complain that Cyrus kept the best ones. See, here's the point. The point is, I think there's a very simple explanation here. Karim Shonim means the unusual ones. In other words, Ahasuerus is not, you know, putting out his plastic cutlery. He's showing the treasures of his kingdom. He put out what is unique. Here you have caves that are 700 years old, more or less, given their age and what their age might have been. And so Shonim could mean anything. That makes something unique.
Mm-hmm. I hear your point.
And especially from the point of view of our writing of our story, it's showing from our story and from his story.
Right. I hear the idea. Thank you. Okay. So we have two approaches now, very different approaches to what this feast is doing here. One, Ahasuerus' political machinations. Two, the downfall of the Jews, celebration of Jewish defeat. The third way to look at it, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I want to note it, is that it's actually God's feast. It's not Ahasuerus' feast. It's God's feast in the sense that this is how God is manipulating the empire in order to put pieces in place for a plan that is going to play out. Go back to the first verse in this book. Vayhi bimei Ahasuerus. It was in the days of Ahasuerus. Who Ahasuerus? He is Ahasuerus. Hamolech, who reigned, etc., etc., etc. 127 lands. What's the Hu Ahasuerus clause doing there? And it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned from Hodu to Cush, 127 lands. Why do you need to throw in Hu Ahasuerus? This is Ahasuerus. It's a very odd turn of phrase.
It makes you think that he's being pointed out, that guy.
Yes. And that's possible. You could give that answer for sure. The Medrash, though, that I would highlight for you in source number 7 says it's trying to make a statement about Ahasuerus in the course of the story that is about to play out. And what it's trying to do is to underscore the changes he undergoes because God controls kings. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to use my translation, but you can see the original Hebrew there on the sheet. Four different sages speak to this. Rabbi Yehuda says, this is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, who killed his wife for his friend in chapter 1, right? His counselors say to him, kill her, and he does. This is Ahasuerus, who killed his friend for his wife when he kills Haman later on. Rabbi Nechemiah says, Ahasuerus halted construction of the Beit HaMikdash, going back to what we showed you from Ezra chapter 4, about how in his days they blocked the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. This is Ahasuerus, who decreed that it be built, which is the Medrash that Ahasuerus also was the one to order the restart of the building. You know, how that works in the history, go back to the first week. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Ahasuerus, in whose day all of the troubles came. This is Ahasuerus, in whose day all of the good came, at the end of the story. And then the sages took it personal. Ahasuerus, before Esther came to him. This is Ahasuerus, who stopped living with Nidot once Esther came to him. She reformed him. So the idea here is that God controlling kings. And he is Ahasuerus one way here, but you watch, keep your eye on the ball. Ahasuerus is going to be very different by the end of the story, but it's the same guy. So that's another way to look at this party, is that here's Ahasuerus, he's one person, and God is going to make him over. There's more to be said within this, but I think I'm going to skip source number 8 in the interests of getting to more material. But depending on how you understand the role of this feast, that determines how you understand why it's in the Megillah at all. Why did we not start this Megillah with chapter 2 and Esther becoming queen? Right? So either approach number 1, teaching us about Ahasuerus' character, This is somebody who is very, very concerned about status, and that look at the feast and look at how that demonstrates it. Or it's framing the state of the Jews in their exile, or it's showing how God is moving the chess pieces into place. One other thought on the purpose of this feast, from the Persian perspective on its purpose. And I noted this very briefly in week one, but I wanted to call your attention to it and make sure people saw this. Take a look at source number 9, please. This is from Herodotus, from the histories, and his description of Persians, and specifically Persian drinking. He says, "Moreover, it is their custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk, and what they approve in their deliberations is proposed to them the next day when they are sober, by the master of the house where they deliberate. And if, being sober, they still approve it, they act on it. But if not, they drop it." So we have our big meetings at the party. Everybody's drinking. They're very creative when they're drinking. And then once they've sobered up, we ask, yeah, but did that make any sense? And if they still think it makes sense, then they say, okay. However, look at the next line. If they have deliberated about a matter when sober, they decide on it when they're drunk. They really value both perspectives. That's Herodotus. Now remember, I said to you in week one that some people call Herodotus not the father of history, but the father of lies, because he's giving you a Greek perspective on the Persians. The Greeks did not necessarily feel any need to respect the Persians. But the point here is that maybe that's another perspective on this big party. Why? Because as I brought you in source number 10, also Herodotus speaking, assuming Ahasuerus is Xerxes, which seems to be the most compelling read of the Persian kings, well, you get the story here about how Xerxes is actually named king while his father is away on a mission. He's supposed to be in charge, and his father is killed, and then Xerxes has to decide what to do about this military mission against Egypt, and then whether to go against Greece. And the key thing for us, and I'm not reading out the whole thing here, is the last line in source number 10. After the conquest of Egypt, after he takes up his father's battle against the Egyptians, intending now to take in hand the expedition against Athens, Xerxes held a special assembly of the noblest among the Persians so he could learn their opinions and declare his will before them all. And this is early on. I think I read somewhere it's actually year 3. In the reign of Xerxes. So it's entirely possible that at least part of this big feast where he invites all the nobles is a gathering to discuss whether to go to war against Greece. By the way, just so you know, Xerxes, bad idea. But, you know.
How can they make any decision after they drank so much?
Some people need that to make a decision. Okay. I'm good with that. Okay, the problem with this is also, I don't know what that does to his second feast. You could come up with explanations, but it's not really that important for us. Okay, before we go on to Vashti, and we only have 15 minutes left. This is ridiculous, we have such little time. But any thoughts or comments on the feast before we move on to Vashti? Okay, on to Vashti then. Yeah, I did see the note that someone sent me in the chat about the vessels of Elam. I'm not sure how it fits in. But I'm going to go on to Vashti right now. So, okay, we have a very odd medrash about Vashti. Midrashim place Vashti as the queen by Babylonian descent. Have you heard that story before?
Yes.
Okay. That Belshazzar was the last king of the Babylonians. Leave aside Nabonides, I'm not getting into him. Belshazzar is the last one. And Belshazzar's daughter was actually Vashti. And that Ahasuerus married into royalty. And in fact, he was the stable boy. There are a couple of different versions of this, but take a look at source number 11. When Vashti refuses to come out to the party, something we're going to have to talk about, he gets very angry. Vayiktsof HaMelech Me'od. He is livid. If we have time, we'll see a Malbim next week where he talks about the different terms for anger that are used in the book of Esther. There's chema, there's ketzef. It's very interesting. But Vayiktsov HaMelech Mo'od, he's really angry. So the Gemara asks in number 11, what did he get so angry about? Like, why is he so livid? Is it just her refusal? So the Gemara says no. Why did her refusal so incite him? Rava explained. She sent a message to him. Stable boy of my father. My father drank the equivalent of 1,000 others. That's the verse in Daniel at that big party Belshazzar made, that he drank opposite 1,000 men. So my father drank the equivalent of 1,000 others, and yet he didn't become intoxicated. Right? He was, granted, he couldn't read the writing on the wall, but we'll give him that. But you have become foolish with your wine. So it wasn't just that she refused. She refused in style. She says to him, who are you? Yeah.
Then he's asking for her to come.
Yes, and we'll get to that. So that is when he's angry. That is when he's livid. Is because she disses him as her father's stable boy. This is supported as well in a Midrash in Esther Rabbah that I brought you in source number 12 that describes four women who took the reins of power over the world. Izebel, Ahab's wife, Atalia, who was Izebel and Ahab's daughter, who killed all the other members of the royal family save one, Semiramit, which is a whole other story among the Assyrians and Babylonians, not somebody from the Jewish line, and Vashti as well, from the nations of the world. So Vashti is portrayed as the major power. Sorry? Okay. So the question that we have to ask here as we read this Medrash is, where did this come from? Where did they get this idea? There's nothing in the story of Vashti that gives me any clear sense that this is what's going on. If you take a look at chapter 1, sentence 9, okay? We're going to read sentences 9 to 12 just to make sure everyone's up on the Vashti story. So I'm reading it in, I'm doing my English translation as we go along, but you can feel free to read it yourself. Vashti, the queen, also made a feast of women in the palace of King Ahasuerus. On day 7, when the king's heart was good with wine, he said to Mehuman Bista Harbona Bikta Abakta Zetar Kharkas, the 7 Sarisim, Sarisim can be officials, can be eunuchs, can be both, who served King Ahasuerus, said to them, bring Queen Vashti before the king in the throne of the empire, to display to the nations and the nobles her beauty, because she was very pretty. And the Queen Vashti refused to come at the word of the king in the hands of these Sarisim, and the king was very angry, and his rage burned in him. That's the passage. So where did they get the idea that she was queen and that he was just a guy who married the queen? Anything in there give you evidence?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It looks like she did it in Beit HaMalchut, which must be the more important place. And he did it in the Bitan and Abida and Chatzel.
So good. So one possibility, one possible piece of evidence, Chana points out, is the location. His party's outside. Her party is in the palace. Isn't that a funny thing? So I think that's one piece of what's going on here.
Also, it says that she has the crown of the kingdom. He doesn't have it. She has it.
Yeah, she's the one with the crown. I mean, I'm not 100% clear on that because Esther is also going to have the crown. So maybe there were his and hers crowns. I don't know. What else might help me get to this? Because so far, I don't see anything that really qualifies as proof. I see nice ideas that, you know, this could help explain something.
I'm not sure if this is, I don't see where the proof would be, but the gum is a question. Why does it say gum? Like, is that something that's...
Gum Vashti Amalka. Well, I would have said it says gum for everybody. It means also. Right. Also Vashti made a party. I would have assumed it's just because right now you just mentioned his party, and now you're saying she also made a party. I wouldn't get so hung up on the also.
Could it be that she refused? Oh, could it be that she refused, but she wasn't afraid. We see how scared Esther is.
Uh-huh.
And here, he's not afraid. She just says, no, I'm not coming.
Right. So I think one of the big points here is her refusal. The fact that she thinks she can get away with refusing the demand of the king. Jeanette, you were going to say?
What's that?
Ruchama, Rakshniya, Jeanette?
Oh, okay.
No, she's not. Okay. Janine after Ruchama. All right, Ruchama, then Janine.
I read a certain midrash that he asked her to come without her clothing.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. That's not the Ikar here, but we're going to get to that probably next week. We'll see. Janine?
The fact that it repeats the word Hamalka, because it says
Right, it keeps stressing. Right, we keep stressing her title in this. Good. Good. Moish, what do you have?
Well, it really it doesn't come from the Megillah at all. I have to be very careful with what I'm going to say, and if I say it wrong, please buzz me out. There was a very military tradition for the 2,000 years before the modern, before AD, that a victorious king would sexually assault the losing king. Okay? That was part of the victory celebration. And I think this is just a continuation of the same thing. What he had available was Vashti. So Chazal put it in their way, but it's just a continuation of this very, very...
So it's interesting. It's interesting that you say it, because I suspected that there might be some kind of tradition that might somehow be fitting into this, not what you're mentioning specifically, but something external that was being brought in here. And I looked high and low in academic literature and couldn't find anything to support it. So if you can find something, you know, to base that on, the contention that there was this kind of a tradition, I would love to see it. Yeah, thank you. That would be very helpful, because I was wondering about that. So I'm going to go further with this at this point. Sorry, Ellen? Yeah.
I just was wondering if there's a difference. In the beginning, she's Vashti Hamalka. Then when she refuses, she's Hamalka Vashti.
Right. So yes, there are those who point out not only the emphasis on the title, but the order of the titles as well. That the order of title and name. When are you Vashti, who is queen, and when are you the queen, first and foremost? Also worth noting. So I think that they arrive at this idea by trying to solve two questions. Number one, her imperiousness, her statement of "forget it, I'm not going," but also Ahasuerus's odd request. We usually think of a queen as the king's personal relationship, right? The halacha in Judaism is that no one else is allowed to marry the queen after the king dies. That's a no-go. If you remember that Avshalom rebels against David, and his advisor, Achitophel, says to him to take the king's concubines for himself as a way to demonstrate that he is now the king. The queen is, and I hate to use this phrase because it's very misogynistic, but in that society, the queen is the highest chattel of the king. And almost like a badge of his, you know, status. Why in the world would he put her on display for everybody? That's the opposite of what he wants to do. You're taking that which makes you you, and putting her on display in front of everybody.
Because he was drunk.
Sorry?
Because he was drunk.
Don't think so. I think he got himself drunk to work up to this. But that's where this is coming from. But there's a lot to say about this, and we're not going to get it all in the next 5 minutes. But there are other ways to answer both of those questions of why she refused and why he did this. I think this became the Gemara's answer for a particular reason. And here you have to explain a little bit about Midrash again. There are Midrashim that are tradition. I have a Kabbalah, I have a tradition going all the way back that such and such was happening in that story. Or when you're dealing with halacha especially, I have a medrash that is a tradition that this is what that verse means. However, you also have midrashim that are deductive. Where there's a text, the sages are bothered by something in it, and they provide you with an analysis of it. If you take a look at source number 13, we're not going to read it aloud now. I just wanted to show it to you. Rabbi Yeshaya Detrani, writing 800 years ago, talking about the different kinds of medrash, points out that sometimes the medrash is the sages themselves analyzing a text. And I think that's what's going on here. They're analyzing her fearlessness. And not only are they analyzing her fearlessness, but they're also looking at a model here. And this is my chiddush. This is what I really wanted to make sure to point out. Vashti is not the first one in this situation. We have a precedent for this in Tanakh, for a woman like this, who has power as a result of her father, and is not beholden to her husband, and in fact does whatever she chooses.
Michal.
So Michal is definitely on our list. I'm going to get to her. But I'm thinking more. A woman we already mentioned. We're going to talk about her too. Good. Take a look though back at number 12. How about Izebel? Izebel, daughter of the king of the Tzidonim, marries Ahav and does whatever she wants with the kingdom. Right? Ahav, there's a vineyard he wants that his cousin has, and his cousin will give it to him, and poor Ahav is depressed, and his wife says, don't worry about it, honey. And then she has his cousin executed, and he gets the vineyard. She launches a campaign to murder all of the Nevi'im, all of the prophets. That's not Ahav's relationship with Eliyahu. That's her relationship. She does what she wants. And I think Vashti is understood as fitting into that mold. And we're going to start on this for the next 3 minutes, and then we'll get up to continue it next time. They're looking at a biblical archetype. So Izebel is one, and I gave you references on the sheet here. This is why I wanted people to have a Tanakh, so that they could look them up. But we're not going to look it up because we only have 3 minutes anyway. But in source number 14, I gave you references to Malachim Aleph. That first line there, that's Izebel and Ahav. In which, you know what? We're going to start with that next time, and I'm going to make sure we actually do go through the verses, because I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it to actually see it. But we're going to see Izebel. We're going to see Atalia as well. Atalia, the one who killed everybody else within the line of the monarchy. We're going to talk Michal. We're going to talk about the daughter of Paro. These are the model on which the sages are building when they make their deduction about what happened with Vashti. So to sum up in a couple of sentences what we've accomplished today. Number one, we saw the three layers in the party of Ahasuerus, which give us different views of why the party is recorded here. Whether it's to teach us about Ahasuerus as a schemer, whether it is to show the celebration of the defeat of the Jews as something that's going to frame our status throughout the rest of the story and our vulnerability in exile, or as God moving all the pieces into place, and where we bring the story here in order to show how all the pieces are being moved into place, with the fourth idea that maybe the party is their planning meeting regarding a war against Greece. And then we have Vashti, who is described as being the real power, the one who really owns the throne. And the question that we asked was, where in the world did they get that idea from? And I think the answer is, they're really bothered by Ahasuerus' conduct and her conduct. Why does Ahasuerus have such a need to put her on display, and he gets so outraged when she refuses? And why is it that she's able to refuse? And the answer is because she fits the model. She fits the model of the queen, who is herself the holder of the power. More to talk about, God willing, with this next week, so we'll do that. I want to spend a little time next week also on why Ahasuerus consults the council he consults, and then move into chapter 2 and the selection of Esther. So we've got a lot to talk about. But thank you very, very much, and have a good week.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Torchiner. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Sure.
I just want to point out, I think some people are missing Rabbi Torchiner's email because it might be going elsewhere in your email. It is coming from him from Toronto Torah. I don't know whether you
want to
expand on that.
So I asked people in the beginning, it was before you got on, and it seems like almost everybody responded that